You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room. I'm Christopher Jones, and here with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the completion of the TOS cast on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, celebrating Picard Day, an Abramsverse comic book series, Anthony Montgomery and Garrett Wong interviews, a real-life Defense Department Starship program, the upcoming browser-based Star Trek game Infinite Space, and a few more tidbits about the next Star Trek movie. And we'll be discussing Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home with our guest panelist Mike Rittenhouse of Five-Year Mission. So let's go ahead and step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How is everything at the Cetacean Institute today?
Oh, it's beautiful. We got two new whales, George and Gracie.
Those are real beauties.
They are real beauties.
Did you go swimming with them?
I did. I put on my special underwear and I went and swam, and I did a mind meld. I actually did a mind meld with George first, and we talked about football for a little bit. But then Gracie told me she's actually pregnant, and this is news to me. News to me.
Yeah, nobody knows that. So, all right. Well, otherwise, how's everything up there around your area?
Well, the sun came out today. I know we have our weekly monsoon update. I had monsoon yesterday and monsoon tomorrow, but today is bright sun. What about down where you are?
Yeah, it's bright and sunny down here around Tokyo as well. It's actually hot. It's the first day that it's been hot.
Yeah.
And I kind of hope it doesn't stay that way. All right. Well, since we have to be inside and stay cool today, why don't we spend that time talking about Star Trek news?
Why don't we? And I think we have some breaking news, don't we?
Actually, yeah, there is some breaking news. Some good breaking news, in fact. Why don't you tell us what that is?
Yeah, so the Hollywood Walk of Fame, which I believe is the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce, has announced their 2012 Walk of Fame recipients, which are people who get their, I guess it's their handprints and their name put into the Hollywood Walk of Fame. And all of the original series cast has been on the Walk of Fame for several years, and there's been a fan campaign to get Walter Koenig, who of course played Chekhov in the original series, to get him on the Walk of Fame, and they've announced, wow, he's going to be on there next year.
Great. So finally we have the whole cast there, deservingly so.
Yeah, and hopefully now someone will tell him where those nuclear vessels are, now that he's a little bit more important. Oh, and also, on this list is Malcolm McDowell, who we talked about last week, or the week before, anyway, who was Soren in Generations. So getting another Trek alum on there. Of course, he's known more for his other roles, like Clockwork Orange, but I think we can take
him for one
of ours.
That's true, but I will have to say that it's about time that Soren was on the Walk of Fame.
I think this is the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce saying that they're happy Kirk is dead. They're happy with the ending of Generations, and they wouldn't change a thing.
I'm not sure if I would go that far, but we'll pretend.
Yes.
All right. So there are a lot of other people, a lot of other names like Adam West in here. I think McDowell and Koenig are the only two Star Trek connections.
I think so.
Around.
I wouldn't mind seeing Vin Diesel in a future Star Trek film. I think he could make a great villain. And Adam West, of course, is connected with Batman, which there have been a lot of Star Trek alums on Batman, the animated series, various other things. But I don't think he's ever made it onto Star Trek proper.
I don't think so, no. It's great to see Koenig finally there.
Yes.
We have the complete cast.
Yeah. And now, they haven't announced when exactly they're going to have the ceremony, but I'm sure once they do, there'll be a whole bunch of press and we can talk about it again.
Definitely so, and it'll be a great day, a very special day, like the next little item that we want to talk about, which is a holiday we had recently.
Captain Picard Day. Yeah, that was June 16th. Of course, not until June 16th, 2370, but I think we can celebrate it here in the 21st century.
Well, we're celebrating it in advance.
So how
there's nothing wrong with that.
How did you celebrate Picard Day?
Well, I did my traditional celebration. It's what I do every year. I sit down at the dining room table, and I make a bust of Captain Picard out of mashed potatoes.
That makes perfect sense. Is that the same bust they used during the time travel montage in Star Trek IV? Those looked like they were made of mashed potatoes as well.
Yeah, mine's a little bit less polished than that, though.
I see.
Mine has that more, you know, down-to-earth feel to it.
I see. A little bit of gravy on top, perhaps.
Yeah. So how did you celebrate Captain Picard Day?
I spent my entire day facepalming, which I think it made it hard to teach my classes, but it let everyone know that I was, in general, disappointed with the way events were transpiring.
I see. Well, I'm picturing that image of Picard and Riker facepalming together when you say that.
That's exactly what I'm going for.
The famous motivational poster.
Yes.
All right. Very well, good. We'll have to wait another year now to celebrate Captain Picard Day.
Right. Of course, I believe the next Star Trek holiday will be Anniversary Day on September 8th, which I believe is celebrating the creation of the Federation Charter. Am I correct about that?
Oh, boy. I don't know off the top of my head. We'll have to check that out.
Maybe we can get some letters, people correcting us.
Yes.
All right.
All right. So next item on our agenda today, this is an interesting one. I think that there are a lot of fans that will probably really look forward to this. And then I think there are a lot of fans that might not be totally happy with the concept that's going on here.
No.
And this is IDW, the comics publisher. Mm. Everyone knows they published a series of comic books leading up to the first JJ movie called Countdown.
Yep, I have a copy of that in my closet. I love it. I read it every couple months.
There have been a few others since then. I think some Nero comics.
Mm-hmm.
And the plan now is to kick off a monthly comic series, an ongoing monthly comic series that is based on the Abramsverse.
Right. And the twist here is that not only is it Abramsverse, but it's actually original series episodes reimagined.
And that's the kicker.
Yeah. Now, what do you think about that?
For a lot of fans, I think. Well, it's an interesting concept. Because they're doing it in comic form, mm-hmm. I think I really have no problem with it at all. If they were to do a TV series based on the Abramsverse and they just went through and they like redid all the original series
episodes.
That'd be
fantastic. Like the the Psycho remake that was made in the 90s, but with Chris Pine and Zach Quinto.
Yeah, it could be interesting, although it might come off more as a parody than than an actual show.
Indeed.
I don't know if I would go for something like that. But
no.
As a comic book, mm-hmm. I have no problem with it. I think there probably is a segment of the fan base that's not going to be thrilled with the idea of reimagining. And I don't know if they're going to do all of the original series stories, or they're just going to do some of the original series stories and some original stories, kind of mixed in.
Yeah. Well, they are kicking it off with not the original pilot, but the second pilot, Where No Man Has Gone Before, which wasn't, of course, the first aired episode, but that's the whole conversation we can have. It was the first episode shot that starred William Shatner as Captain Kirk. Mm-hmm. And so at least they're starting it off at the very beginning.
Right.
Which will be interesting.
And that's where maybe we'll get our Gary Mitchell in Abramsverse.
Right.
Rather than it being in the next movie, we're going to get it in the first issue of this new Star Trek comic.
Right. And I am really excited. I love Star Trek in comic form. I love seeing those beautiful drawings of the Enterprise. Sometimes they can be a letdown, but I really enjoyed what IDW has done so far. And so once this goes on the street, I'm looking to remember. Oh, that's right. In September, they're releasing Star Trek 1 for $3.99. I will pick that up and definitely report back on what I thought of it.
Now, when you pick these up, do you get the printed form or do you get the digital ones for the iPad, which are really nice?
I actually own both for Star Trek Countdown. I have the trade paperback edition and all three issues on the iPad. I haven't actually gotten Nero. I probably should. It keeps slipping my notice.
Yeah, I don't have an iPad yet, but I, of course, have an iPhone. Mm. And so I have the digital versions on iPhone. And it's a little cramped to read them there. Mm. But what I do like about it is that if you hold the phone in portrait view, you see the whole page. And you have to zoom in if you want to kind of read it that way. But if you turn it landscape, they've done it very nicely that it only shows you portions of the frames and landscape, and then you can kind of slide through. It's really nicely done. It's kind of a fun way to read comics, I think.
Yeah, that was fun. I think, actually, the Marvel and DC iPhone apps do the same thing, which is quite impressive.
It's really nice. Yeah. So a few more notes on this. First of all, it's based on the Abrams verse, but it's not just IDW completely going out on their own on this.
Right.
It is actually being produced, and the creative direction is coming from Roberto Orci,
right,
writer-producer of Star Trek and the next film as well. Mm-hmm. And they also have artists. Stephen Molnar is going to be doing the art for the first issue, which is being written by Mike Johnson. Mm-hmm. And there are going to be two separate covers, which is typical. You have the comic store cover, or you have the newsstand cover. Tim Bradstreet and David Messina are doing the covers for the first issue. Mm.
Those are all their names. I'm somewhat familiar with, being a on and off comics fan. Those are well-known names in the industry, and so that should get us off to a good start.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see, and I'm definitely going to pick it up when it comes out. I'm not a diehard comic fan, but I do like to see what they're doing with the Star Trek stuff.
Yeah, and of course, we're still in a bit of a dry spell for Star Trek, so anything extra I can delve into, especially something visual. I love the visuals of Star Trek, and so something I can look at and study will be definitely on my radar.
I wonder if they're going to use this as a vehicle for leading into the next film the way that they did Countdown for the first one, or if they're going to do a separate series again, like a special comic series as a lead-in.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to find out. Obviously, they're still working through everything, and Orci and Lindelof and Kurtzman are hard at work on the new script and just figuring out what everything's going to be. And so since Orci's involved, I wouldn't be surprised to see this lead into the next movie. I doubt the movie will reference the comic or anything, but it really wouldn't surprise me to see this be sort of I forget what they call it, but an in-between between the first film and the second film.
Very interesting. Try to bridge the two. Mm. Okay, well, next item that we were going to talk about, this Q&A that Anthony Montgomery, who was Travis Mayweather on Enterprise, did with StarTrek.com last week. And we are going to talk about that, but another Q&A interview came up today with Garrett Wong, who played Ensign Harry Kim. So we're going to talk about both of those a little bit.
And these are pretty similar characters, I think. They both were very low-ranking crew members, and they both didn't get an awful lot of screen time. They were kind of underused during the whole run.
Kim got a little more play than Mayweather did. And of course, Kim became the crew member that got killed over and over.
He did. I think him and Janeway were the ones that they killed basically whenever they had a chance.
Especially poor Kim. I mean, the early seasons, it was like, give the guy a break, you know?
Yeah, really.
But anyway, so what's going on in these Q&As here?
Let's see. So the Anthony Montgomery was a fan Q&A, so they actually asked questions that the fans had brought. And trying to think what was most interesting that he talked about. He did say, as we did a couple episodes ago, that Enterprise was canceled before its time. He said by season four, we'd actually hit a nice stride. So I thought, he said, we would be around for three more seasons and do several movies and everything. So I don't know about the movies, but I definitely think that the show could have had a few more seasons in it once it had hit its stride with season four.
Yeah, I definitely agree with him that it was canceled before its time, and I definitely agree with him that they were hitting their stride in season four, and I think that the later seasons would have been great Star Trek. And you know, that's not unusual. If you look back at the other series, they hit their strides around that point as well, which really bummed me when they canceled Enterprise, because it was almost like the studio had amnesia. You know, you're being critical of this series because it didn't come out of the gate with super, super ratings.
Right.
But yet you should know that the last three series took a few seasons, as a lot of television series do, not just Star Trek.
Yeah.
So I definitely agree with them there.
Well, and this ties into the Garrett Wong interview, where he has a lot of complaints about the producers of Voyager. And one thing he says about the early seasons was they were told to not emote. Let me read a quote. During the entire first year of filming Voyager, actors were required to reshoot certain scenes because of excessive emotion. I personally had to reshoot only a couple scenes because I learned my lesson early. But Kate Mulgrew held the record for the most reshoots, numbering in the double digits. So, you know, you'd think they would know that when they're first getting the show started, they're going to do some weird things. I think they did the same kind of weird things with Enterprise. And it just takes a little while for the producers to be comfortable with the actors and the actors to become comfortable with what the producers want and for things just to happen more naturally, like the later Voyager seasons really were.
Yeah, especially, I mean, you see that like on The Next Generation. By the time you get to the later seasons, you can tell that the cast and the producers and everyone are just so comfortable with each other.
Yeah.
It's just almost like, you know, they're having fun shooting and it just all plays naturally.
Yeah.
It's odd that in Star Trek they tend to use so many actors with stage backgrounds and theater backgrounds. To ask them not to emote is counterintuitive for the actors, sure.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I can definitely see where someone like Kate Mulgrew, for example, would have a real problem playing that way and would have to reshoot a lot if that's what they wanted from her, because it would have to seem unnatural to a lot of these actors.
Yeah, definitely.
To do that.
And one thing Wong complains about is, he says, if you can allow Captain Picard to bawl his eyes out for 10 minutes over the death of his relatives in the opening of the film Generations, then how on earth can you not allow Captain Janeway the chance to show some genuine emotion? Which I think just shows the difference between how they thought of the film, which they sort of handed it off to the director and let him, you know, make it more and more emotional, and what they saw as the TV show, which was more steady and let's not change anything and let's make sure everybody stays the same from week to week.
Yeah.
But it must be frustrating for those actors.
Yeah, it must be. This is interesting. I haven't really heard this before. I hear this and that, you know, from actors, what happened on the set. This particular thing I don't recall really hearing before.
Yeah.
It's very odd.
Yeah. Well, so back to the Anthony Montgomery interview. What did you think about what he said about the Enterprise cast joining showing up in the Abrams films?
Yeah, that was that's probably what I found the most interesting about that Q&A. First of all, the way I read it was that there are a lot of fans who would like to see the Enterprise crew integrated into the next J.J. Abrams movie.
Right.
Which I don't really personally feel that there's that many fans out there that want to see that. Again, nothing against Enterprise, because as people know from a couple of shows ago, you and I are very fond of Enterprise as a series, and we think that it doesn't get the love that it deserves.
Yeah, and as he says, you know, we like it, but he says fans come up to him and say, how can you be a part of, you know, Enterprise? You know, Scott Bakula was the worst captain ever, and he ruined the franchise. And we don't
which
think
I
that,
totally
but,
don't agree with.
But that is a fan belief that's out there. So it's strange to hear him saying both things. Yeah.
That is a fan belief that's out there. And as we said before, I think Bakula played Archer exactly the way should have been played, given the context of the story. But it's for another discussion. In this case, I think that you could probably find a way to integrate the Enterprise crew into the next Abrams first movie by using a mechanism like the Temporal Cold War, Future Guy, something like that, to incorporate an element of time travel that somehow pulled them in. Or perhaps you could have T'Pol there because being a Vulcan, she would still be around. She would probably still be a member of Starfleet or a member of the Vulcan Science Academy or in some way involved in the Federation.
I guess that point. That's what I'd probably be most likely to see, is someone like T'Pol, who we already know is capable of living a much longer time. And especially with the destruction of Vulcan, this would affect her quite deeply. And it'd be interesting to see her as part of that, assuming she wasn't on the planet.
Yeah, that could work out. But even though you could do it,
I think it would
feel contrived, which, you know, was already a problem with some things in the first JJ movie.
Yes.
But I don't really see how it would benefit the story.
Yeah.
So it's not really something that I personally want to see as a fan. I would have liked to have seen Enterprise go seven seasons. And then the other thing related to this that I had not heard before, but he said, and I believe that I heard last week that Bakula had also said this recently, that the plan from the studio back in 2004, 2005 was that Enterprise would inherit the Star Trek film franchise. This was before J.J. Abrams was handed over the keys to the franchise.
He says the cast was told they weren't going to do DS9 or Voyager movies, but that they were going to be the ones to inherit the film franchise after the next-gen movies.
Yeah, which I had not heard. I always thought that DS9 would have been the perfect series for the big screen, until the way it ended, of course. Which would have made it a little bit difficult to continue the story, although they have continued the story in the novels, officially continued the story in the novels, giving it essentially an eighth season.
Right. I mean, just so, as they've continued Voyager, making Chakotay the captain.
Yeah,
in,
so
in
it,
the novels.
It could have been done, but the Voyager I never really saw as being a series that would carry over to the movies. Enterprise, I never even thought about it.
No.
until this came up. And whether or not I think it would make good movies, I'm not positive. I think it's hard to say because it was canceled in midstream. It's kind of hard to say. You know, maybe if they had let it run its course, they had let it naturally evolve to the founding of the Federation at the end of season 7, maybe that would have set up something that could have worked well as a series of movies.
I mean, it definitely would be interesting to have seen a Romulan War movie. There's sort of this undercurrent in the Abrams films of everyone remembers the Romulan War, and so they can't wait to go, you know, kill some Romulans. But we really haven't actually seen that war, so it would have been interesting to see that from the Enterprise NX-01 point of view.
Yeah, I would have liked to have seen that whole conflict portrayed in a series or in a movie, but especially in a series. Kind of like the Dominion War on DS9, you know, finding out what happened in the Dominion or in the Romulan War.
Yeah.
It would have really filled in a lot of gaps that are kind of understood by Star Trek fans as having taken place, but we just really don't know about.
Right. And so, and they also asked him what type of underwear he wears. And I believe, just as you and I do, he wears blue underwear.
Of course. He was a member of Starfleet in the 22nd century, the famous Starfleet blue undies.
Everyone wears blue underwear. It's very important.
We will, in case people haven't seen it yet, we will put a link in the show notes to the tribute, video tribute to Starfleet blue undies that was done on YouTube.
Right. All right. One last note about the Garrett Wong interview.
All right.
He says that he was not allowed to be a director on Voyager, unlike Tim Russ and Robert McNeil and many other Trek actors, because he said something to a TV Guide interviewer about this emotion issue. So apparently there was a feud that we didn't know about between Wong and Berman. So this is
interesting.
It's weird to think behind the scenes, because Kim just comes off as this, you know, everybody loves him.
Yeah. I don't know about that. I also had not heard that.
Yeah.
It seems to me like that might not quite be accurate. Because I don't know, that would sound like kind of a petty issue. You know, some of the actors have gotten shots at directing, some of them haven't. Some of them I think have been asked to. Go behind camera. Some of them I think have wanted to and kind of cautiously been given the director's role. It depends, I think, on a lot of factors. I think it's probably not quite as simple as that explanation, so I don't want to really come down on either side of it, other than to say that maybe it's true, maybe it's not. There's probably more to it.
yeah
it'd be interesting to kind of find some more references to this.
Definitely, yeah.
Try to find out exactly what really happened there.
Yeah, but on a positive note, I think we both like the Mayweather and Kim
Mayweather
characters, and would have liked to see more of them on both shows. So regardless of what was going on behind the scenes, or whether or not they were happy with how their shows ended or how their characters were portrayed, I think these things were really successful, and I enjoy what they brought to each of the shows.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, having characters who, or actors whose characters were underused on a Star Trek series is not new, and we
no,
do hear some unhappiness from them after the fact. That's common with the original series as well.
Yep, definitely.
So, all right, well, let's move on to another interesting story that's not directly Star Trek related, but I would have to say it's definitely Star Trek inspired.
Right, and definitely.
This is a story about the 100-year Starship Study that is a program being undertaken by DARPA, which is the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, which I don't know its exact role within the government, but it does have a .mil military domain. So it is related in some way.
As I understand it, they're basically the R&D department of the military. They're the ones creating, or at least sponsoring the creation of brand new weapons and ships, and of course now moving into starships. So this is the 100-year starship study that it would be a perfect thing for them to be working on right now. So they're looking to make interstellar travel possible in about a century, which, as I guess if you think about it, we've only had flight for about a century. So if you look at a logarithmic curve, I could definitely see us flying to another star within a century. It just seems crazy to me.
I think it depends on what their goal is in getting to another star. Some form of interstellar travel within a century, I think, is feasible. But the big kicker is propulsion technology.
Yeah.
So that's going to, I think that has more to do with the time frame. That and simply budgets.
Right.
Getting governments to actually spend money on something like this are the two biggest obstacles to some type of interstellar travel. But but it's very interesting that they're undertaking this at this point in time.
Yeah.
And I think it shows at least a little bit of forward-looking initiative and vision on the part of a government-related agency, which is, you know, something that you don't often get.
Definitely.
So it's nice to see this, although they're spending what by government standards is a cup of coffee at Starbucks for you and me, which is $1 million on this project, which is probably not going to get them very far, but hopefully it's just seed money to kind of get things going and get some outside brain trust working on it as well.
Yeah, it shows that they're interested in the concept and in making it happen. Yeah. So bringing it back to Star Trek, how are we doing on matching the Star Trek timeline? Obviously, we're avoiding World War III. That should help, right? If we never have that happen. But we need Zeph from Cochrane to invent the warp drives. When is that supposed to happen in the Star Trek time?
Well, some of the pieces are in place. Steppenwolf has already recorded Magic Carpet Ride, so the jukebox has been invented.
There we go.
That's all good.
Montana's still there.
And Montana's still there. There are nuclear missiles whose casings can be used to create a rocket ship.
Yep.
But I don't know, you know, to the real question of the science, probably, about how close are we to building some sort of technology that could carry us towards a warp-capable vessel?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't personally think we're doing all that well. I think that we may get there someday. Mm-hmm. I'm not so confident that we're going to get there on anything like the Star Trek timeline.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we've got 150 years before the Enterprise NX-01 were to have launched. So, I don't know, 100 years, Interstellar travel, another 50 years, warp 5. Let's believe it's going to happen, you know.
Well, you never know. It could. It's mainly a scientific issue right now. If we knew how to do it and the government saw some kind of benefit to it, they could allocate the money.
Right.
And from an engineering standpoint of the actual ship itself, I think we could do it. If we really put our minds to it, I think we could do it.
Build the ship,
Scientifically, we have to figure out how to harness the energy to get to propulsion that can get us to stars in a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah.
And then traveling faster than light is a very tricky thing, which appears to be impossible, but you know, I kind of think it's probably not.
They said many things were impossible that turned out to be pretty easy, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely appears impossible. If you try to approach it from a classical point of view, it is impossible. But I just kind of have a feeling that there is more to it. We don't know as much about the universe as we think we do.
Right.
And who knows in 100, 200 years what we'll be able to do.
Yeah.
So this is really interesting. And we'll put a note in the... we'll put a link in the show notes to several links about this, where if you're interested, you can go find out more about this project.
Yeah.
All right. So speaking of hopping in a ship and taking out to space, let's jump to the next story, which is about another game that's coming up. This is a browser-based game called Star Trek Infinite Space that's being put together by GameForce.
Yeah, and this excites me because... we have two other games sort of in the pipeline. We have Star Trek Online, which is out now, which is sort of set in the future, you know, after all of the movies.
And 25th century.
Exactly. And then we have the new, I believe it's just called Star Trek at the moment, that's set in the Abrams universe. But
that's
this game...
That's the console game. Yeah.
Exactly, the console game. This one is, the browser-based game, is actually set in the Deep Space Nine timeline, which is really cool because... We haven't gotten many games, especially not many action games, set in that time period.
That's true, yep.
And let's see. So, it's free to play. It's sort of a browser-based MMO, from what I understand. What do you think of this project?
That's right. Well, it's interesting. I think it's always good when you have competition.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of, at least initially, I kind of viewed this as competition for Star Trek Online. When I first heard about it...
Mm.
And the screenshots that I saw, it looked a lot like Star Trek Online.
Mm-hmm.
And anytime you have competition in anything, of course, it's going to push them both to be better.
Right.
So I'm positive on that. I also think that the idea of making this game free to play is going to attract a lot of players.
Yeah.
As I mentioned on a previous show, I think one thing that has kind of hurt Star Trek Online a bit is the fact that you have to pay... About $15 per month, I think it is, on the low end. You can do a annual membership or a lifetime as well.
Right.
But you have to pay roughly $15 a month to play Star Trek Online after you buy the game. Now, they've lowered the price of the game significantly since it first released. I think it was like $79 when it first came out. Now it's you can get it for like $29.
Mm.
But it's still, you know, for a lot of people... Asking them to buy a game and then pay monthly to play makes it out of their reach.
Right.
You know, and it's just something that they can't do month to month.
And also for many, a lot of consumers, you know, the business end PCs are very popular, but in homes, many people have Macs these days and you can't play Star Trek Online on Macs at all. And they're saying definitely on this one, there'll be Mac play, there'll be cross platforms so you can play with PCs as well. And that'll open
up
a whole
new
audience.
Yeah, that's going to attract a lot of users, too, because there are lots and lots of Star Trek fans who are dedicated Mac users. And, well, like myself, you know, I'm a Mac user. I have Windows installed on my Mac just so I can play Star Trek Online.
Right.
But Star Trek Online is very, very demanding on the hardware.
Right.
And I'm not able to play it by running Windows under Parallels virtualization.
Right.
I actually have to boot my Mac as if it's a Windows machine using Bootcamp so that I can take full advantage of my video card and my memory in order to play Star Trek Online. So this browser-based concept for Infinite Space is going to open it up to a wider audience.
Yeah. And I mean, definitely the new Enterprise in the Abrams movie is a Mac, so it wouldn't make any sense to make, you know, Chekhov boot into Windows between shifts just to play Star Trek on, just to play, you know, Star Trek game.
That's right. That's true. Hold on, Captain. I have to reboot.
Exactly. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous.
There's a Klingon bird of prey off the port bell. Okay, I'll have photons ready just as soon as I reboot.
Boot back into OS 10, and I'll launch iPhoton Torpedo.
Yeah, so, and you know, this is the one thing here. I've been hearing a summer release for this, mm-hmm. as in summer, where we are, why it's warm outside, and I have the fan on right now. Summer. It doesn't seem like it's on track for that, though. What do you think about that? From what we've seen, footage at E3 and so forth.
Yeah, I've not heard an awful lot about it, but they seem to have a pretty big showing at E3. I would expect it to get pushed back, maybe not quite holiday, but late summer at the earliest. I think we'll definitely start to see some bigger pushes before the game actually releases.
Yeah, I think so too. And just one more note on this for Trek fans. This game, it's being done by GameForce, and they've brought in a couple of Trek veterans that I think all Trek fans know as consultants on this project, and that's Mike and Denise Okuda. Mm-hmm. And they also have Lee Sheldon, who is a very experienced game designer, author, producer, and script writer who's writing the storyline and the game missions for this. Yeah. So they do have a lot of experienced power behind this project, both in terms of Star Trek veterans and game developers.
Right.
So it'll be very interesting when the final polished piece comes out and it opens up for play. It's going to be very interesting to see.
It's interesting. They seem to be building it for nerds, but also making it easy for anyone to play. So it'll be interesting to see if they can get a nice big user base.
Right. And we'll put a note to this in the show notes. And we also have a link to the trailer if you want to watch the footage from E3.
Yeah.
You can see that.
There's a lot of Galaxy class starships exploding. It's very exciting.
Lots of those. They like to do that on DS9 too with the Odyssey, right?
Yep.
All right. So let's jump just a couple of last little news items here that are related to the next Trek movie. We'll try to get right through these. First quick one here is anger over Paramount putting Star Trek II in promotional materials as the name of the next movie.
Right. Of course, everyone knows that Star Trek II is The Wrath of Khan. It was released 20 years ago. It's one of the greatest Star Trek movies ever made. And Paramount used this as a sort of working title in some promotional materials they created for advertisers.
It's just a working title.
Right. Yeah. And so they were very clear. Paramount was very clear and that it's a working title. They're not calling it Star Trek II. It's just going to be Star Trek something. And actually, there's a quote here from Roberto Orci in the TrekMovie.com comment section. He said, "Damon might have a title, but we're not sure. Can't just be Star Trek, insert fancy word here. Can't be Star Trek II or the two eyes. You know, very tricky." So what do you think? What can they do for a title? I think Insurrection was like ridiculous. I see him not wanting to go in that direction.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to be called Star Trek II. It's just a working title. You know, that's promotional material intended more for Hollywood. Hey, these are the movies we're working on. You know, it also had G.I. Joe 2 next to it. It had all these this, that, you know. I think the movie will be called Star Trek something.
Yeah.
I think it's possible that the movie may just be called something without Star Trek attached to the name.
That would be interesting.
I think it's possible, but I also think it's unlikely. I think after what happened with Enterprise, I think that there will be too much nervousness about doing that, so they probably won't do it.
Well, just halfway through the film, they'll put up a new title. You know, Star Trek, whatever they said the title was.
Oh, so the title changes halfway through the film.
And there'll be more drums. There'll be more drums and some sort of more upbeat music as the movie goes on at that point.
It'll be kind of like The Ready Room when we do our enhanced podcasts and the artwork changes in iTunes and on your iPhone.
That's just what they do.
It just pops up there on the screen halfway through.
Yes.
I was thinking that they could call it Star Trek, not Wrath of Khan. That would be That'd be the actual title of the movie.
There we go.
Just so people know, this we're not remaking Wrath of Khan. It's Star Trek, not Wrath of Khan.
I was thinking Star Trek, the undiscovered first Khan search for... I don't know. I'm still working on it. That's my working title.
Is this Yoda who's coming up with titles?
Yes.
I think you've been in Japan too long, because that sounds like Japanese syntax right there.
Well, in Japanese, it makes a lot more sense.
It does make sense in Japanese, yes, if you use that syntax. But in English, translating it, not so much.
Probably. All right. So there's a little bit more we have about Abrams. Obviously,
yeah,
we're trying
to jump ahead here a little bit.
We had the All Abrams show last week. We're cutting down the Abrams a little bit this week. We talked about TrekMovie.com. They actually have an exclusive interview with what I'm calling Lynn Dorkman, which is the combination of Lindelof, Bob Orkey, and Alex Kurtzman. Lynn Dorkman, pass it on.
It's just easier to say because it's such a mouthful to say the other three.
It just takes forever. And so what they said some interesting things, Chris. Why don't you take that away?
Okay, well, of course, the questions that they keep getting asked over and over and over is about timeline, largely. Mm. Not timeline as in how did Kirk and Spock meet, but timeline as in you're working on the script, aren't you? And why isn't the final script out yet? Why? And why haven't you started shooting yet? And, you know, I think a lot of these questions come from people who should know. I mean, this isn't just average fan people we're talking about here. You know, these are people often within the industry who should know more about how a movie is put together.
Yeah.
And there just seems to be so much pressure. I think it's this impatience that we have in general in the society today that, like, okay, the first one's done. We got to get to work on the second one right away. And we got to get that out the door right away, too. And obviously, in their answers, you can see that their concern is where it should be, which is that we have to make the best product. We have to make the best movie that we can. Right. It's Star Trek. Star Trek is very important to the fans. It's very important to us. It's something that you should handle with care.
Yeah.
And we don't want to rush it. We want to make sure that we do it right.
Yeah, I was really impressed how they sort of deflected every question that was about, you know, why isn't it done, into we just want to make a great movie. And, you know, we'll take as much time as we need, you know, until Paramount actually tells us, go make the movie. We're going to keep working on it because I think we've mentioned the Writers Guild strike every single episode. Let's not let that pass. The writer's strike caused the first script to not be quite as good. And so letting them take more time with this one is a really good thing.
Yeah, because they couldn't tweak things they wanted to tweak, where if they had pushed the release out further than post-writer's strike, maybe they could have gone in and fixed a few things that they wanted to touch on there.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I think this is how they should handle it. Personally, I mean, I really want to see the next movie. I would love to see it tomorrow. You know, I'm waiting for it. I was the same way when we had kind of longer gaps between the Next Generation films than we had between the original series films.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, think about it as a fan. 10 years from now, do you want to look back and say that, okay, yeah, this film wasn't that great. It felt like it was rushed. This one wasn't that great. You know, I think the studio was trying to go to the well too many times on here. Or do you want to have movies that are... What's that?
Did you say go to the whale? I think maybe getting ahead of us.
I did say go to the whale, but we'll save that for the feature.
Let's do it. Please go on.
All right. So, you know, or would you rather have movies that are 5 years apart, but when you look back on them, you say, God, that was a great movie. You know, every one of these movies is just a great movie. And that's really ultimately, I think, what you want.
That's the important thing.
So... Let's calm down about the production timeline and let them do their job. I mean, they're professionals. This is what they do.
Yeah.
And one thing about creatives, you know, you can't rush. I'm a creative. You can't rush ideas. I mean, sometimes things hit you and it hits you and in a week you've done something great. Mm. And sometimes things have to simmer for months or years before you find that perfect, you know, recipe there. So
now one thing I do think what we've had since the Star Trek film has been not much other than Star Trek Online. They seem to be really ramping up with the promotion, with getting this new game out and then the new console game in the fall, and also this new comic series I'm really excited for. We're going to have more Star Trek to digest month to month, and it should make the wait for the next movie a little bit easier to handle.
Oh, definitely will. It's like with the Next Generation movies. We still had Star Trek around us all the time, yep. So it wasn't so bad, you know, waiting year after year for that next movie to come out.
Yep.
All right. Well, we should wrap up here. Just one last little item here, mm-hmm. because we've talked about this before. They said that the sequel won't be a message movie.
Right. Now, some of the movies have been message movies. We're going to talk about Star Trek IV. You could sort of say, you could definitely say Star Trek VI and then Insurrection were more message movies. And so people have been asking, you know, is this going to be that same sort of thing? But I think what Bob Warkey said was they made the first one a message movie. No, it was in there. Maybe they were moving too fast. Maybe you couldn't quite pick up on everything they were going for. But it was about something, and I think I would agree with that. I think I'd love to get into the message aspects of the film on a later podcast.
Okay.
But what he says about this one is they now don't have the burden of meeting everybody.
Exactly.
So they can all be, let's see, I'll just quote, they can be united force from the beginning. I think it allows us to think more about the world that they live in. And I think that's exactly what we were talking about last time. They've set up this world, and the next movie they can have it be, they can really get these ideas out that they were sort of struggling with in the first one because they had to have so much plot and coincidences, I suppose, to get everybody together.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what the first movie was, the setup. So now we'll have to wait and see what they do.
Yeah, so it's good to hear that they're on the same page, I suppose.
I think so, too. So, I have very fond memories from the 1980s, after the kind of dark search for Spock, of going to the theater to see Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. And this was prior to the J.J. Abrams movie, the biggest box office for a Star Trek film. And it's, ever since it was released, really been a fan favorite. And today we're going to talk about The Voyage Home. And joining us today, of course, Greg is here with me, and joining us today is Mike Rittenhouse from the band 5-Year Mission. Mike, how are you today?
I'm doing good.
Great. Well, we're glad you could join us.
Yeah, I'm really excited you're here, Mike. I didn't get a chance to talk to you guys last week, so it's good to finally meet you here.
So, Mike, The Voyage Home, what are your memories when this movie... First of all, did you see it when it came out, or did you catch it later on down the road?
I did not see it at the theater. The Final Frontier was the first movie I saw at the drive-in, actually.
At the drive-in?
And that was actually my first Star Trek movie that I saw. The Voyage Home was one of the first movies that I watched at home. I wasn't very familiar with the characters the first time I saw it, so I missed a lot of the inside jokes for Star Trek fans.
Yeah.
But I still really enjoyed it, so I think that the idea that they were going for, like reaching the general audience, was pretty well executed because, I mean, I enjoyed it even though I didn't know a lot about it. I don't know if I have like a lot of like fond memories of the first couple times I saw it, but yeah. I definitely enjoyed it.
So it's kind of very similar to what they're doing with the JJ movie here, of trying to go for the non-Trek audience a bit more, because 2 and 3, especially 3, was very much written for the core Star Trek audience. I mean, if you were not familiar with the TOS characters, you really couldn't get into the search for Spock.
They even had when they released it in Europe, they had a little, before the movie, reel to sort of tell you what happened in films 2 and 3 to just get you completely caught up, just in case, you know, you're just walking off the street.
Yeah, because it opens with them on Vulcan with a Klingon bird of prey, and you have no idea what that's about. I mean, maybe you think they're always in that ship, and it broke down, and they're stopping off to get it fixed.
Ugly Federation starship.
Have some food packs, yeah. So, Greg, what was your very first time that you saw Voyage
Home? I'm not sure. I think I've mentioned before that I remember seeing Undiscovered Country in the theaters. This film would have come out, I believe, when I was about 6 years old, 6 months old. So it would have been a little hard for me to make it to the theater at that point. But I'm pretty sure I saw it pretty early on in my childhood. My parents watched Next Gen with me, and I don't remember watching much of the original series. So probably much like Mike, this would have been one of my first introductions to the Star Trek characters. And because it's sort of a lighter film, it's definitely one they would have shown me earlier than, say, Search for Spock or even Wrath of Khan, which were much darker and not so much good for a, you know, 8-year-old.
Yeah, right, right. Interesting. So you guys kind of approached it from the opposite direction that I did, I guess, because I grew up watching TOS in the rerun when it was coming out in reruns when I was a kid, so I grew up watching that, and of course, the motion picture, Wrath of Khan, Search for Spock. I was really, really invested in Star Trek when this movie came out, and so I remember going to the theater, and for me, it truly was a continuation of the story that I was waiting to, you know, okay, Spock is back alive, what's going to happen in the next movie? And I've always thought from the first time that I saw it that it was a great movie. One, it's not my favorite Star Trek movie, but it's up in the top, I think, 3 or 4. I ranked them recently. I don't remember position this. I think it's 3rd or 4th. But at any rate, I thought it was a good idea for them. And this is what Nimoy said in the commentary to this movie on the DVD as well, that after the very dark, heavy themes of The Wrath of Khan, The Search for Spock, they wanted to just go have fun, kind of bring a lighthearted nature back to Star Trek. And I think they really succeeded in doing that, and they really connected with the audience in a way that Star Trek hasn't been able to connect with the general audience until the J.J.
movie. I think that might be part of my problem with it. You know, we talked in the past, this isn't my favorite Star Trek film. And I think part of it, because I don't come from the original series, I'm not looking as much to have fun with my Star Trek, at least not in this sort of way. I'm looking for more of the dark storylines from DS9 or, you know, Wrath of Khan, Undiscovered Country. I prefer that side of Trek rather than this one.
Yeah, I can understand that. So, Mike, after you said Star Trek V was your kind of introduction into the movies, and then you saw Voyage Home, but since then, of course, you've gone back and you're very immersed in TOS. Coming back to the Voyage Home, after you know all the backstory, how did that kind of change your view of this movie?
I think that it just caused me to like it even more, because now I get all the jokes and all the references, and now that I know the characters, it's even more enjoyable. And I think also, not just with watching the series, but also seeing the previous two movies, I'm pretty sure I saw The Voyage Home without ever seeing Wrath of Khan or Search for Spock. And so I really didn't understand what had come before that. Like you said earlier, with them being with the bird of prey and everything, I was a bit confused.
Yeah, you don't know why that's there. Or why Kirk is in trouble, why they are maybe concerned about going back to Earth. Yeah, exactly.
So once I went back and watched everything and then watched it again, I completely understood what was going on at that point. So it would definitely, the movie made a lot more sense to me, but I'd say that I didn't necessarily like it any less or any more. I would still say it's probably my favorite of the original cast.
Oh, really? You like it even more than The Wrath of Khan?
Well, that's maybe another discussion
another
for us.
Discussion, okay.
I'm actually not a Wrath of Khan fan.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
I asked that because that's typically, you know, the fan overwhelming fan favorite from the TOS
films. Not that I don't love the movie, but I would place it pretty low on my list of the movies.
Is it because you're scared of those Centaurian slugs going in your ears?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I can understand that.
I have to cover my ears and just kind of close my eyes and hum for the first 15 minutes.
All right. So, well, of course, the premise of this movie is going back in time. First of all, time travel. I personally like time travel stories. Greg, I think you're not that fond of time travel stories. And I think you might find it interesting that William Shatner, again in the commentary, stated very clearly that he also is not a fan of time travel as a storytelling device. And that he was initially against the idea of this movie for that reason. He believes that time travel just makes it too easy for the writers. It's like this deus ex machina that the writers can use to just make everything okay whenever they need to in the story. And I think that's one of the reasons you're not fond of time travel, right, Greg?
Right. Well, it's sort of a... looking for a word. It's a problem that they just created so that they could go to 1986. You know, they're sort of thinking, you know, what sort of problem could we have so that we can have the characters in this other time period?
Yeah.
Whereas it's not, as we've talked so much about on this podcast, it's not something that came naturally. You know, after Search for Spock, well, of course, they'll go to 1986 and go on board the USS Enterprise and do a tour of a fiberglass factory.
Yeah.
They're just looking for a way to do it. And in the same sort of way as Assignment Earth, as we had this great feature by Lisa Lynch this week on Trek FM about how Assignment Earth was this pilot conceived by Gene Roddenberry, but he just decided to shoehorn it into Star Trek because he couldn't get the pilot made.
Yeah,
he's
I was kind
like,
of
well,
hoping
we'll
to
use time travel
yeah.
to make it happen.
Yeah,
and I feel this is sort of the same way. We wanted to go to 1986, so maybe it doesn't make sense, but we'll send him back in time and hope it works.
Well, you know, the original story idea apparently for this movie was not to go back and get Wells for a space probe, but the original. Very original concept here. It was still time travel. It was still to go back to 1986. But the problem was that there was a disease in the 23rd century that could only be cured by a plant. And this plant had gone extinct in the 20th century. And they had to go back in time to retrieve this plant.
Yeah, I think they found an even worse villain. You know, we talked about the guy being not quite as good as a captain.
Yeah.
But I think a disease is even worse than a guy.
Well, and then you have the plant. So you have guys and you have plants. So, yeah, I think they've decided plant would not be the best villain here. So, but, you know, Nimoy said that that whole idea just seemed kind of too weak to build a story around. So they moved on from that, and then they came to this concept of the Wells, which, I mean, it's kind of a crazy idea. I know it sounds contrived in order to force the time travel, but, you know, Star Trek has always been, especially TOS, has always been about social commentary. And so this is a case, even though some people feel that this movie maybe is a bit too preachy on social issues. Coming into the Wells, and at the time that this movie was made too, I think it was a pretty good message and fit into Star Trek pretty well. So I actually kind of like the concept of the Wells.
Actually, I was looking it up recently, and the humpback whale is doing much better than it was in 1986.
Well, that's because of this movie.
I guess it's entirely possible. That it was all Star Trek IV, raising public awareness, and they stopped hunting whales.
Well, it's two things.
Problem solved.
Star Trek IV raised the awareness, and that helped a lot. And but also, Spock, during the mind meld with Gracie, he told Gracie how to repopulate the species.
Right.
So that's also part of the reason. So
I knew that there was a bigger reason for him to go swimming.
But Mike, I know how Greg feels about the whales, and he'll tell us about that. But Mike, how do you feel about the concept of this movie, going back in time to get whales from the past putting them on a bird of prey and bringing them back into the future. Does it work for you as a story?
Yeah. I mean, I find it very fascinating. Certainly not the typical, you know, villain causing trouble and, you know, the Enterprise crew has to stop it or whatever. And you know, going along with what you guys were saying about, you know, the from the discussion from the last time about the villains and, you know, and how the villain should be a captain and, you know, not just a guy.
Not a guy.
And it, yeah. I actually think that the concept of this movie, how there is no actual villain in the movie, yet there's still a danger that they have to resolve. I think that that was very cleverly put together, you know, and I think that that has had a lot to do with Nimoy, you know, with, you know, he's such a, you know, like a pacifist or whatever. So, you know, I think that I think that it's a cool concept. Yeah, the first time you watch it, especially if you're not super into Star Trek, the whales seem very silly, and can even come off preachy. But I think that it's pretty much stood the test of time as, you know, being still a good story. And I mean, the movies, it's still fun to watch and everything, but yeah, I mean, compared to some of the other movies where there is a villain and a more Star Trek kind of story going on, that, you know, it's maybe not quite as exciting of a movie, but I think you know, it's good that they have a movie that's not just like all the other ones.
Yeah, I'm definitely glad that there are some movies that don't have a big villain that they have to do a one-on-one fight with. I wouldn't want it every movie, but it is good to have a few here and there.
Yeah, so as this movie goes on, okay, so they start out on Vulcan, and that worked really well for me. Like you said, I think maybe it didn't necessarily make sense to Star Trek fans who weren't that familiar with the backstory, and of course to the general audience, it just was, that's how the movie started. Then they head home, and then this space probe comes in. And I thought all this was fairly set up pretty well. You know, they had Spock kind of retraining his mind, retraining in the Vulcan way. And the way that was being done, in a way, was kind of picked up in the JJ movie. You know,
yeah,
with
I love that.
The way that he was doing his training with the quizzes on Vulcan.
The questions at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was very cool to realize that was echoed in the JJ film.
Yeah, and so they get in there. And, you know, for me, the idea of them traveling back to Earth in a stolen Klingon bird of prey was kind of interesting and kind of exciting, because it was something that they would never do, you know, and they're at risk. And of course, this is kind of missed by a general audience without knowing the backstory of Star Trek. They were kind of at risk of being shot down, I think they actually say in the movie, by their own people, because you have this bird of prey flying through Federation space. And I'm sure if they say, oh, no, it's me, it's Kirk, you know, yeah, right. I'm sure it's really you, you know, but, so that worked well for me. And, but then as they're coming along the way is where we get into the whole time travel slingshot around the sun. And then when everyone kind of, goes on a drug trip there,
right.
Which, is kind of the first for me kind of weird thing in the movie, is this whole sequence when they are, doing the slingshot around the sun. And I guess they've all kind of like blacked out and they're all kind of having these visions. And I get the concept, you know, I think the concept is that time is only linear to us because our brains have put time into it. There's a past, a present, and a future, but in reality that doesn't really exist in the universe. And these visions are kind of representing this idea that, you know, all time is intermingled as they're going through time travel.
Right. I see what they were going for.
It's a weird sequence, though. Yeah. I'm just curious, when you saw this sequence, even when you see it now, what are your what thoughts are going through your head? How about you, Mike? What do you think when you see it? And I think it would make that, just that sequence, I think, would make a great song for 5-Year Mission.
Yeah. Anytime they have a sequence like that, it seems a little silly and unnecessary. I mean, it makes sense to have it maybe in like one episode or something, but and I have to be honest, it's actually been a while since I've seen the movie. I haven't had it. I didn't get a chance to watch it before the discussion, but I mean, I'm still quite familiar with it, but I don't really recall the sequence in detail. So
okay,
well, yeah, it's sort of reminiscent of a motion picture where they're pulled into the wormhole, and
yeah,
there's
kind of
a little bit too much. They spend a little bit too much time with rainbows coming off of their faces, and you know, everybody go to the left, everybody go to the right. I really think up till this point, the movie really works for me. You know, it's very much a continuation of 2 and 3 as we see this trilogy. Even though we're on the Klingon ship and not on the Enterprise, it still is all of the main characters. We even see Spock's mom for a little bit and see a great conversation between her and Spock about what he should do in the future.
Yeah, and that was a scene that was, I think, critical for the most recent movie as well. Yeah,
it's really cool going back to a scene like that and thinking, you know, that is never going to happen. You know, we see how much of an influence Amanda had on Spock in the prime timeline, and knowing that's not going to happen at all in the Abramsverse was really affecting for me. But yeah, once they do this, I think I tweeted that once they say, you know, we've got to do time warp, that term time warp is what starts to set off bells in my head. And then they do the actual weird drug trip sequence.
Because you would think they would remember from their past experiences with time warp that this may not be a great idea. But
yes.
But at the same time, I think that they also know that it's kind of their only choice.
Right.
To try it. Yeah.
Right. So plot-wise, it makes sense. And I love the argument between McCoy, where McCoy's just saying, you know, we can't do it. This doesn't make any sense. You know, that's sort of me out there, you know, saying, what are we going to do? We're going to go back and we're going to find some whales and we're going to bring them back and they're going to talk to the aliens and they're going to leave? What are you talking about?
Yeah.
So,
well, that comes.
I really appreciate
that. Comes a little later, I think. And then Kirk says, you got a better idea? Now's the time.
Right. So, exactly. Yeah. So, but yeah, they do this time warp and they have the weird thing. But then, you know, then we're in 1986, just all of a sudden.
Yes.
Boom, we're there.
Which for me, okay, so I guess this is the point where things kind of start to unravel for you a bit, right?
Yeah, exactly.
See, for me, the view, them flying in over San Francisco, I always love this scene. It's just kind of, because you always see them in space, you know, it's always a star field or they're orbiting a planet. And to see them on the bridge, even though it's a Klingon ship, but to see the view screen and to see the San Francisco skyline, especially as we know it, it was just kind of, it's a neat scene for me. But I take it not for you.
Well, it is. It's basically where the Star Trek film ends and the 80s comedy begins.
Okay.
And so this is sort of the transition scene as we're leaving space and we're entering the 80s.
Yes.
It is a beautiful scene. I will definitely give you that.
And they pulled off the 80s very well. I mean, I think that's, a testament to Nimoy's direction in this movie because of the way that he shot it. I mean, just taking out to the street, you know, he said, you know, the way they're dressed, Spock in the white robe with the headband, you know, ripped off. And he says in the commentary, you know, it's like, you know, I've seen people wearing crazier things. We're just going to go out the way we're dressed. We're just going to go out. We're just going to shoot this on the street. Worked, you know, really well to really capture the 80s feeling, which is something that makes the movie feel a bit dated now. The soundtrack in particular feels quite dated. But in a way, the fact that it feels dated may be a sign that it was done well because it really did capture that 80s flavor.
Yeah.
It was the 80s. I mean, so naturally they capture it. But, you know, they could have still tried to capture the present day and it could have kind of come off as a kind of a fake feeling with it being put inside Star Trek.
Yeah, I definitely think they were able to capture the time period better than... what was the name of the Voyager episode where they went to the 90s? Was it Future's End?
Future's End, yeah.
So that didn't feel so much like the 90s as much as just generic
the past,
present day.
Sometime, yeah.
Right. Whereas this, yeah, really feels like the 80s. And especially a scene that works great for me is in the bus with the punk playing the song. I think the song is like, I hate you, you know, everybody die.
Yeah.
Very, very 80s, and he's a very 80s character. And it's a scene that works great, and it's very funny. And I'm, you know, that sort of thing doesn't bother me at all.
Yeah. So, well, Mike, how about for you? When they take to the streets in 1986, in there, I mean, I love that when they're landing, Kirk tells them all, officers, remove your rank insignia. Like, this is going to make a really big difference.
Right.
Otherwise, they have the same uniforms on. They just take the rank insignia off the uniforms, right, and they're going to blend in that way. I guess maybe they yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. And then, but Spock ripping the fabric off the robe and putting it on was hilarious for me.
Yeah. As far as humor, I think this movie has a bunch of really great humor beats. And I really think Nimoy was able to stretch his comedy chops. Maybe the other directors weren't quite so comfortable, especially on the show, in giving him humorous things to do all the time. Maybe one thing every few episodes, but here he's hilarious.
Yeah.
Well, usually on the show, it was always like at the end of the episode, he was the butt of the joke.
Yeah, right.
Where he's actually making the joke. There's several times where it's very clear that Spock is actually making a joke that we're supposed to laugh at.
Intentionally making a joke,
yeah.
As Spock, yeah.
Mm. Like colorful metaphors.
Yes.
I love the colorful metaphors. Yeah, that's good. And even before they land, I mean, his conversation with McCoy, mm-hmm, as they're coming in, and he says, what McCoy says, oh, I have to die before I can understand your...
Yes.
And he says, pardon me, I'm receiving a number of distress signals.
Right.
I don't doubt it. That was just great. I mean, it's classic McCoy-Spock banter there.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope they can capture that in some of the newer movies.
I think they will.
Get that same banner.
I think they will. There was a little touch of that going on in the movie. Yeah, just a little bit. So how does the movie progress for you, Mike? I mean, they get there, they get to 1986, they land the ship, which they cloak in the middle of the park, and then they head out into the streets. And that's kind of where the adventure really takes off, as far as the movie goes. That's where the story takes off.
Yeah. I don't know. I think that that's really where the movie just becomes popcorn, like more so than any other part of it, because you've got these characters that have no idea how to act. I mean, they might as well be on a strange new world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They're walking around trying to blend in, and it's just so funny because this is their world, but they have no idea how to talk to these people.
Mm-hmm.
And, they're using all of these terms, right? I just thought that was very, funny, them trying to blend in their own world. And, they're so out of place that it's, they might as well be on a distant planet.
Right.
And it's extra fun for the audience because we're from that world. Especially, back in 1986, where the images on the screen looked like what we see every day,
mm-hmm,
that made it even more fun. Like nowadays, now that it's 25 years later, it's not quite as much fun, I think, as it would have been at the time, because, now some of those things seem strange to the people that are watching it now for the first time.
Yeah, especially to people who weren't really, who maybe were just kids at the time or weren't born yet, who didn't actually, live through the mid-80s, yeah.
Exactly. Some of the hairstyles and the clothes and things, just seem probably ridiculous now to people that grew up in the last 10 or 20 years.
Yeah, they think it's just like some kind of makeup done for the movie, right? You're like, no, that's really how people looked.
Well, they were looking at taking the next-gen cast back in time as well. They looked at a couple of different places, Ancient Rome or Sherwood Forest, and they settled on actually doing our future. So I wanted to ask Mike what he thinks of the difference between going back to present day versus going back to the future? Is it more or less interesting to you as a concept?
Just in as a concept for Star Trek.
Yeah.
I think both are very interesting in different ways. Of course, going back to what we've known as the present or the past is very overdone with Star Trek. I mean, we've seen it so many times. And going back to what will be our future was a very cool concept for First Contact. And I thought that that was not only a bold move for them, but it was just kind of really cool that they're saying, okay, you know, like what do we need to be at risk? And, you know, of course they could go back in time to anything that happened in Earth's past, but why not go back to something that happened only in Star Trek's past and show us an era that has been mentioned a few times in Star Trek, but not really shown on screen, and you know, give us more insight into that time, like the Zefram Cochrane time.
Yeah.
I thought that was really cool. So I think in comparison, you know, both are very cool ideas, but I think First Contact was a really cool new concept.
Yeah, I agree with that. I like time travel stories in general. I like going back into our past or our present or the far future. But in terms of Star Trek, I also really liked in First Contact that they did go back into their past, but our future. Mm. Because not only does it put them out of, it makes them a fish out of water for themselves, but it also helps to kind of fill in more information that helps make Star Trek richer for us at the same time. And they don't run that risk of doing something that turns out to be cheesy.
Right.
All right.
So moving on from fish, be the fish out of water, to mammals. So this is where the film becomes sort of a message movie, as Dr. Jillian Taylor is her name, and she gives us a sort of rundown on how whales are being killed. And we have this really gruesome video. I was sitting here watching it with my roommate, who was sort of wincing at this video of the whales being cut apart.
Yeah, that was like really like the Greenpeace tie-in.
Yeah.
And I think Nimoy actually mentions that on the commentary, in fact.
So is this a really big deal to Nimoy? Is that why we're getting it?
I'm not sure about that. I'm not going to say that because I don't remember that exact thing being mentioned. But I think more so than that, I think it was at the time that the movie was made. Not that whaling is not an ongoing issue, but it was just a very timely message that was incorporated into the movie.
Mm. So movie sort of becomes a message movie for a little bit, but there's still some humor in this. As Spock goes swimming with the whales, and he actually goes and mind melds with Gracie.
Yeah, which I loved, because there's not that many occurrences through Star Trek, but if you look through TOS, you can put together this trail of strange things that Spock has mind melded with. He mind melded with the, I think it was the Nomad space probe.
Okay.
Yeah.
He mind melded with a Horta.
Of course.
Which is the molten lava rock creature from The Devil in the Dark. He has used mind meld through a wall before.
Oh, really?
More than once, yeah. Here he's mind melding with a whale. So he's saying these unusual things that Spock has mind melded with.
You know, in the J.J. Abrams movie, I'm actually very surprised that he did not mind meld with himself.
Oh, yes. That was a missed opportunity.
I was kind of waiting for that.
Yeah. Let me read my mind.
Yeah, that would have been great. You know, if Kirk had sent Spock off the ship, they could have met in the cave, and then he would have had to do the mind meld.
Oh.
With himself.
But also at the end of the movie, they had an opportunity to mind meld.
They did. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's when I thought maybe he would like share some of the history with himself to kind of...
Well, I mean, that kind of makes sense, yeah. That I mean, doing that, there could be a reason for that, yeah.
Well, maybe someone should start a website with the these strange things Spock has mind melded
with. I'm sure
with.
Someone is listening and registering that right now. Strange things that Spock has mind melded with .com.
.com, yes.
Site coming next month.
I'm going to go ahead and reserve that that web address so that I can sell it to the highest bidder.
Yeah, do that. And also be sure to register iMailed, because
iMailed,
you'll get a big paycheck from Apple for that a couple of years from now.
iMailed is coming out soon.
All right. So he mind melds with the will, which helps them get the information that they need in order to continue with their plan to save the future.
And it's, I guess this is sort of the reason they decide to go with these whales rather than look in the ocean for more, because they already have a mating couple. There's already a child whale, I suppose. And so these make perfect sense for them to take rather than trying to find wild ones.
Right, right. And all they need is the help of Dr. Jillian Taylor. So at this point, I mean, are you thinking that everything is just too easy for them?
It is pretty easy. I mean, they sort of land and, you know, a bus comes up and says where to go to see whales. And, yeah, everything is sort of going hunky-dory at this point. We do know at this point that the dilithium crystals are breaking down.
Right.
And is there another problem? I believe that's the main problem. They're also trying to figure out what to do with the whales once they get them.
Right, yeah. The problems are that the dilithium crystals need to be recrystallized. Otherwise, they won't have enough power to get back to their own time.
And, so, unfortunately, they're in the only century in which it's possible to recrystallize dilithium crystals.
That's right, because they can't do it in their own century. So that's the engineering problem. That's their technological problem. And then the other problem is that in order to get the whales back to the future, they have to find a way to carry the whales there, and they need to find a 20th century material, solution that will allow them to hold these whales inside this bird of prey.
But of course, they don't have any money, and because it's a Klingon bird of prey, they don't have replicators to create money, so they have to sort of figure out what to do to get these big sheets of fiberglass.
Right. Now, Mike, do these engineering problems, the dilithium and the containment area for the whales, do these work for you? As these sometimes seem in the story like created things to give other cast members something to do while Crooked Spock ran off
somewhat,
to be the main characters. So does it feel that way to you too?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, you know, it's interesting peril to put them in, you know, like, you know, can they even get back to the future, you know, if they can't fix the dilithium issue, you know. But, yeah, I mean, it does seem like busy work for the other characters.
Yeah.
It seems, you know, it feels a little manufactured at times.
Yeah.
But, of course, we do get out of this, I think, the one thing every single person remembers from Star Trek IV is Chekhov looking for the nuclear vessels. And, you know, where are the nuclear vessels? And that never gets old, you know, as much as it makes no sense given what Russians actually sound like. It still is hilarious.
Yeah, that is the classic scene. And you know, one reason I think that scene still works to this day is the way it was shot, of just going out on the street and shooting it basically unscripted. The Nimoy has said that they just went out, they put Chekhov and Uhura out there on the street, and the people passing by, I mean, these are people passing by. These aren't actors coming by that he's supposed to talk to. So you get these very, very natural reactions from people that you've got this guy in the middle of the street asking, where do they keep the nuclear vessels? And
so, like, why couldn't Uhura be the one asking?
Right.
Well, that's the joke. You know, you've got the Russian on the street in the U.S. during the Cold War asking, where are the nuclear vessels?
Exactly.
Right.
Which worked really well. But even the woman who finally answers him was not originally, I mean, she wasn't brought in for the movie. She stopped and answered him, and they signed her to a they have to sign them to like a one-day contract or something and pay them for the line, you know. But it was just so natural. It's one of the great scenes. And
yeah, it plays really well.
And that was, you know, of course, the result of this somewhat manufactured problem for the other bridge officers to solve. And another scene that is a result of this is one of the other classics in all of Star Trek, really, which is Scotty trying to use the computer.
Yes. I believe that's an old Apple II.
It is.
Or one of those.
Yeah, it's an old Apple. I don't know if it's an Apple II or if it's one of the first Macintoshes, but yeah.
He sits down in front of it and just, you know, computer. Hello, computer.
I love when he thinks he's figured out the problem and he picks up the mouse and tries talking into that.
Well, they tell him, does McCoy hand him the mouse, I think?
I think,
right?
McCoy hands him the mouse and says, apparently McCoy knows more how to use it.
Hello, computer. Just use the keyboard.
But then he gets the keyboard and suddenly he's a whiz.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
Everything happened with just the keyboard.
Yeah, he types like 300 words a minute or something.
I wouldn't be able to do that with an Apple II at this point. You know, only 20 years later, I wouldn't be able to do that.
Right. And he says, how quaint. I mean, if you can think of anything that you've used in your life, technology that is now antiquated for us.
Yeah.
And maybe you were good at it at the time, but if you picked it up now, you would not be able to use it the way that you did.
Even a typewriter, I wouldn't be able to use as well as Scotty was using that
computer. And man, I mean, he goes crazy on that keyboard.
He does.
But that itself is funny too. I mean, it's kind of the joke, you know, it's like, they're a whiz even with this ancient technology for them.
Yeah. And it's interesting putting McCoy and Scotty together. I don't think these are sort of pairings they've never really done.
That's true.
McCoy and Scotty, and then Uhura and make sure I'm saying that McCoy, Uhura and Chekhov. Yeah.
Uhura and Chekhov. Yeah.
And Sulu. Sulu's off by himself, isn't he? What's he up to?
Well, Sulu has to go and find a way to get the plexiglass or fiberglass, whatever it is that they end up using, to get it into the ship. And, of course, he's a pilot, so he goes after the helicopter.
Right.
Which provides us with another very interesting scene in this movie.
I'm really not sure what he does to get the helicopter. He sort of goes and talks with a pilot and they're chatting, and next thing we know, Sulu's flying a helicopter.
Right.
Maybe there's a deleted scene that shows him, you know, getting the guy drunk and stealing his keys or something.
No, that was in First Contact, getting but I don't know. I think it was like this kind of camaraderie between pilots or something. It was like, oh, you're a pilot too. Cool. Yeah, yeah. So you want to take my copter for a spin? I think it was basically that.
That's very possible.
So, Mike, how do all these scenes, for you, this kind of unusual pairing of the crew and the humor. I mean, for me, the humor in this movie works, whereas the humor in the next movie in Star Trek V just completely flops, because for me in this movie, the humor is very organic. It just comes naturally from their situation. Whereas and because it was successful with the audience in Star Trek V, they intentionally tried to inject humor into the script and it just doesn't work.
Well, I think the opening to Star Trek V was very enjoyable. It didn't feel too forced. With the camping trip, but a lot of the other humor throughout that movie it did feel very manufactured, not as natural, not like The Voyage Home.
Yeah. So in The Voyage Home, it really works for you as well.
Yeah, and I also, like you said, with the odd pairing of the crew, I think that was an interesting way to go, because a lot of them hadn't really done much together as just teams like that before.
Yeah.
And that made a very interesting new aspect to the cast.
Yeah. And of course, to talk about them trying things again in Star Trek V, they had this weird thing between Scotty and Uhura in the next film that came out of nowhere that did not work as well as the pairings did in this one.
Yeah, that for me is even stranger than the Spock-Uhura thing in the JJ movie, because at least with Spock and Uhura in the JJ movie, there was a little bit of flirtation from Uhura towards Spock in the original series in the very, very first few episodes.
Right.
So like they at least...
In Charlie X.
Yeah, they at least had something that they could pick up on there and just say, well, maybe in this alternate timeline that that connected and it grew. But yeah, the Scotty Uhura thing was kind of... That was the most unusual pairing. And
well, so while
all of Star Trek, I think.
Yeah. So while these engineering problems were getting sorted out, the captain was off having his own little romantic comedy
of
film.
Of course.
Because the captain always has to get the girl, even if she isn't green.
That's right. But I love the way that he gets her in this movie. It's so like... because usually Kirk can... fly in. I mean, he's a cap. He's the captain of the Federation starship, and in the future, everyone knows who the Federation is. And you know, he's like the king in the future. And
exactly.
But here, he's like this crazy guy from Iowa who thinks he works in outer space. That's what Dr. Taylor's thinking of him, right?
Right. And his friend, you know, his friend is on LDS.
Yes, his friend did too much LDS back at Berkeley, I think. Right.
Yeah.
But he still manages to get the girl anyway.
Yeah. And I think it shows that Kirk has that personality.
Yes.
That you do like him, even though even if he isn't bigger than life in your eyes, he still is charming.
Yes.
And I think Shatner pulls that off.
Oh, he does. Well, Shatner is. I mean, some people I know aren't real fond of Shatner, but... You know, I love Shatner, the stuff he's done after Star Trek as well. It's just, there's this certain charm. Yeah. And that's what he brought to Kirk. And it really shows in this movie, especially, I think, because he's able to play it in somewhat of a contemporary way for us.
Right.
That he doesn't necessarily get to do in the rest of TOS and in the original series movies.
Yeah, it makes me wish he'd done more movies like that, where he just got to play, I don't know, kind of a normal guy just trying to do a normal thing, rather than every movie he was in, he kind of was, I don't know, being a detective or something. I liked him just being a normal guy.
Well, I mean, you know what you're setting up here, right? Our movie, Star Trek Guys. I mean, casting opportunity right here.
There we go. Just get Bill Shatner. He's not doing anything now, so...
I've put some horses in there. We've got him for sure. So
I'm sure. So he does convince Jillian Taylor to help him. And she is, how far does she get? Like, she is pretty sure they're on a spaceship. Or she starts to suspect that it's true.
She kind of thinks that they are crazy. But when she finds out that the whales have been shipped away without her knowledge...
Oh, is that all of a sudden schedule, that happens?
She became desperate for help.
Right.
That's when she started thinking that, well, maybe there is something to his story after all. And if there is, he can help me. If he really is from outer space, if he really does have a spaceship.
Right, that's true. I do want to point out the scene where she goes and finds that the whales are gone. We see that the Cetacean Institute... has changed from having the big whale tank to looking how the actual aquarium looks today with just a little wading pool.
Yeah.
It's like when they took the whales away, they also took the whole aquarium and dumped it in the ocean.
Yeah. That's one of those little things that happens. But so she runs out to the park, which is supposed to be Golden Gate Park, although they actually shot that in Will Rogers Park in West Los Angeles.
Oh, really?
Because they said it had just been raining profusely before the production, and the trucks would have gotten stuck in the mud in Golden Gate, so they had to find somewhere
else to shoot.
Well, not
to mention the Bird of Prey would have just sunk right in.
Yes, the Bird of Prey would have sunk, because even though it was cloaked, the weight of the ship would have sunk.
Yes.
Into the park, which is one of the other favorite visuals, which ties in exactly to what we're talking to.
This is where we are
now. I mean, she runs out to the park to find them. And what does she find? She finds a giant piece of plexiglass hanging beneath a helicopter that is suddenly starting to disappear in midair in the middle of the afternoon in Golden Gate Park.
It's one of those great visual effects that's so simple, but it's so effective. Like, all they had to do was paint it out, but it's so shocking.
Yeah. But you think, what are the other people around Golden Gate Park thinking right now? I mean, is this ship really that hidden?
Well, maybe they're all doing what the garbage collectors were doing and just pretending it's not happening.
Yeah, it's like, if I can't see it, it's not real. So that's what's going on. But that's where they bring her aboard, and everything kind of comes together. All their little side missions have come together.
Right.
And then they take off to complete their mission.
And I have to tell you, my favorite shot of this film is the bird of prey decloaking above the whaling ship. It is one of those iconic shots of Star Trek that really gets me every time I see it.
Yeah, it puts things into perspective a bit too, because I always felt that the bird of prey was a really small ship. But then when you see it hovering over the ocean there, it's quite a visual.
Yeah, and so then all we have to do is beam the whales aboard and then reverse what we did to do time warp to get back here, and now we're back in the future. I want to ask Mike, what do you think of how they wrapped everything up? Was it a little too neat? Did it work for you?
It was pretty neat. Definitely, you know, with a little bow on top. the fact that they brought the doctor with them that was a little unexpected when I first saw it. I kind of figured they would, you know, leave her in the past to spread the word of, you know, keep the whales alive.
But they had to bring her back because Kirk got the girl and he wanted to keep the girl.
Right, and he sort of is able to keep her. You know, she disappears a little bit, but
she gave him her number.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah, right.
But I was thinking, it's kind of odd that they brought her to the back to the future when they could have left her in the past. And I mean, if they were concerned about the fact that she knows so much about, you know, what's going on and everything, that if they did know that, or if they were concerned about the fact that she knew so much about, you know, the future and everything, you know, they could have just had some sort of, mind meld to erase the memories type thing.
Right.
But I was surprised when they actually brought her along for the trip. And then in the end, it's like, she like gives him her number or whatever. Like, you know, don't call me, I'll call you.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a hint.
I kind of like to believe that the girl in, I'm not sure if the timeline works out, but the girl in Generations that he was going to ask to marry him, you know, if that was Jillian, that would have worked really well to bring the movies together, rather than what happens, which is she kind of just disappears and we never hear from her.
You never hear from her again, yeah.
I agree. Like, I thought it was kind of weird they came up with basically a new character when they could have referenced so many characters.
Yeah, it was a bit strange. And I think it would have been good. And you're talking about strange that they brought her with them. That's true, considering they left Lily in the past in First Contact, even though there was sort of a thing between her and Picard.
Well, that was Picard, though. Picard would not bring someone back. If this had been Picard, he would not have brought Jillian back, I think.
Interesting.
Perhaps a bit because of the character difference between Kirk and Picard, and perhaps a bit of difference because Picard is from another century in the future,
right,
and their thoughts about time travel and changing the timeline and all are a bit more mature in terms of their experience, you know, 100 years
later.
They're
getting a little bit closer to the temporal prime directive that we see so much of in Voyager.
Right, right. So,
whereas in this film, they don't care.
Yeah, in this film, they don't care. So, all right. So, well, they've come back. They succeed. Against all odds, they succeed in getting the whales back. And they come back. They happen to come back perfectly so they can fly right underneath the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yep.
And then they get the whales out. And then finally, Kirk and the crew are going to be held accountable for their actions in Star Trek III of stealing the Enterprise and destroying the Enterprise. And that's the ending, which I guess the question is, apart from this whole time travel story in the first place, we are doing what Star Trek often does, which is kind of hitting the reset button
right
at the end of the story. And this is kind of hitting the reset button, not only of this story, but of the entire movie franchise, because we go into the motion picture with Kirk as an admiral. Mm-hmm. And here, finally, Kirk is going to be punished for stealing the Enterprise and destroying the Enterprise. And he's going to be punished by being demoted to captain, which is also going to be his reward for saving the Earth.
Yeah, I find, I was telling you on Twitter the other day that I was seeing some parallels between the new JJ film and this one. And this is one of them, that at the beginning of the, or I guess it's in the middle of the new Star Trek film, but basically Kirk is in trouble and he's about to get, maybe not court-martialed, but at least disciplined. And then he runs off, saves the day, comes back, and boom, he's captain and he gets the Enterprise.
Exactly.
And they do the same thing in this one. He really, if he did things that were wrong, I mean, sure, he saved the world. But that seems like that would be different from what he actually does need to be disciplined for. And to give him a sort of, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, slap on the wrist seems very un-Starfleet.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it definitely seems a little more feasible in The Voyage Home than it does in the new movie.
Most definitely.
The new movie is a bit far-fetched. I mean,
oh, it's definitely.
Yeah, you know, they ended up being heroes and saving the day, but would you really reward this fresh out of the academy kid who's barely made it through the academy with a captaincy just because he broke some rules and ended up saving the day?
Well, and is he even out of the academy yet? I mean, he's a cadet when they embark on the journey to Vulcan. And then it's not quite clear how much time has passed, I think, at the end of that movie, right, when they're having the hearing again where he's being rewarded.
I assumed it wasn't a large amount of time.
Yeah, same for me. My impression was that he was still a cadet, and he went from being a cadet to being captain of the Federation flagship, like just pretty much right after these events that took place in the movie.
Right, so as much as I'm trying to draw a parallel, I think this does make more sense. It's just, but it strikes me as a little simple, I guess.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, though. I mean, you're saying that in both situations, he's broken the rules, and yet he's being rewarded. And in both situations, the ultimate reward is that he becomes captain of the Enterprise.
Right, and it's sort of the same story. It's the same lesson that the Harry Potter books kind of teach you, which is break all the rules you want. You know, as long as you save the world or save the school, you're going to get rewarded, and then they'll forget about all the bad stuff you did.
Right. Yeah, that's true. But in The Voyage Home, it is much more plausible that he's demoted from admiral to captain. So I mean,
and it's cute, and it works in the context of the film.
But it actually does work. I mean, and as a long, long time Star Trek fan before this movie ever came out. For me, it was a nice moment, actually. It was like, yeah, you know, Kirk shouldn't be an admiral. I mean, that was kind of like the whole theme through all of the first three Star Trek movies was that Kirk shouldn't be an admiral. He shouldn't be sitting behind a desk. He's supposed to be out there. He should be a captain.
And I love that. I love the scene in Generations where he basically says that to Picard.
You know,
they try to make him an admiral, just tell him no.
Tell him no.
It's not worth it.
And Picard always resisted being an admiral. I mean, Picard could have been an admiral time and time again, and he always resisted it. Because I think for the same thing, he didn't want to go sit somewhere and conduct things from afar. He wanted to be out there. So.
Yep. Now, what do you think about them having a brand new Starship Enterprise?
Well, I think... I was fine with it. I mean, they didn't just build a new Enterprise suddenly. That was another ship, and they renamed it.
Is that what happened? Yeah. I was a little unclear on that. It was just a different Constitution class refit.
Yeah, they renamed it the Enterprise for that crew.
Yeah. It was kind of like an homage to the crew, or like a thank you to the crew that they for all they've done for Starfleet in the past. I think that, yeah, that was an existing ship. I think it was a new ship maybe that had been built, but it was not built for them, and they renamed it. So, and obviously the name Enterprise carries a lot of importance to the Federation. So if the Enterprise were destroyed, they're naturally going to name another ship Enterprise.
Very, very cool. Now, at this point in the continuity, did we know that Sulu was going to be captain of the Excelsior? Because if you look at George Takei in the scene, it looked like he's eyeing the Excelsior, like, ah, I like that ship. I want that one.
Well, he is. Oh, he is. Oh, and that.
Maybe that scene in particular is why they decided to give him that ship
Yeah, it's very possible.
in the later movie.
It could be. I don't recall if. I don't think that there was anything. There wasn't anything on screen, and I don't think there was
Yeah, I
anything that
don't
was
think so.
cut saying that Sulu would become captain of the Excelsior. But there could be something that was kind of cut out that indicated that he was in line for a captaincy or something.
Yeah, that's
That's
possible.
possible, yeah.
Chekhov, of course, was still an ensign, right?
I think so. He's like always an ensign, right? So I guess overall we agree that this was a fun movie. I think that Mike and I like it a little bit more than you do, Greg, at least as a Star Trek movie.
Right. I like it as a funny movie. I like it as an 80s movie. I like the beginning and the end a lot as a Star Trek movie. But if I'm going to watch the series, I'm going to go 2, 3, and I might even just go to 6 after that.
Well, I can't blame you for that.
Ultimately, as I said earlier, it's probably my favorite of the original cast movies. I would probably hold Undiscovered Country and maybe The Search for Spock up there near it. But I think it's probably my favorite. I think overall it's a really good, not just a good Star Trek movie, but a good movie altogether, just for anyone going to see it. I mean, you don't have to know a whole lot about Star Trek to enjoy it. But certainly it's even more fun if you do know. But yeah, definitely a good movie.
Yeah, and for me too, it's the f my favorite of the original series movies is The Wrath of Khan, and The Undiscovered Country is kind of neck and neck there, largely because I like the type of message behind the movie. I like those types of stories more than I like just the pure fun stories. But I definitely like The Voyage Home. I watch it quite often. Actually, fun movie. And I think the success of The Voyage Home at the box office was really important to getting Next Generation into production, which of course led to everything else that we have now. So it was a very important part of Star Trek history.
As much as I have fun, sort of dissing on the whale movie, I do recognize its importance in Star Trek history, and it's even one of the things that got me originally interested in Star Trek. So as much as I like to joke around, I do think it's a worthy part of the Star Trek canon, much more than some episodes or movies that we won't talk about. It's good.
All right. Well, it's a great discussion, guys. It was a lot of fun and hard. I had to skip over a lot of points of the movie that I wanted to talk about, but otherwise, if we touched them all, this would be a about a four-parter, I think. So, thanks for joining us today, Mike.
No problem.
It was great having you on. We'll have to do this again sometime.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, that was a fun discussion of what may not be my favorite Star Trek film, but I think I learned some things. I think there was some learning, some hugging today. So
Well, Greg, I think that Mike and I kind of brought you around to the Voyage Home camp a little bit there.
I think you did. I think you did.
It felt like it.
Yeah, I'll give it a chance a little bit more in the future. Let the humor wash over me a little bit more and just enjoy it as what it is and maybe not what I'd like it to be.
Yeah, give it a shot that way. And so again, th big thanks to Mike Rittenhouse of 5-Year Mission for joining us today as our guest for the discussion. And we would love to hear from all of you, your thoughts on Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home. Tell us what you think. You can send us a message through the website at trek.fm/contact. If you want to leave us a voicemail, you can call us at 646-652-TREK and let us know what you think.
Yeah, that would be great. And as always, you can find me on Twitter at Greg Harbin. That's G-R-E-G-H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N.
Yep, and I'm on Twitter as well. My name is C. Brian Jones, C-B-R-Y-A-N Jones. And you can find Trek FM on Twitter at just Trek FM, keeping it simple. And while you're around our site, be sure to subscribe to our newsletter at trek.fm/subscribe. It comes out every Monday with some Star Trek news, feature articles, update on our podcasts, and some exclusive content for subscribers. And you can also test your Trek IQ by playing Trek Trivia. That's at trek.fm/trektrivia. And you can follow Trek Trivia on Twitter, where Anthony Davis and Mark Stamper conduct live quizzes 2 or 3 times a week.
Yeah. All right. Well, Chris, I think it's about time to stick a whaling harpoon in it because the ready room is done.